Iran's Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi says talks on the revival of the 2015 nuclear deal will be resumed after the new administration takes office in Tehran. Britain reports nearly 55,000 new COVID cases, a fresh highest daily total in 6 months. And Cuban president addressing a protest slams what he calls media's false image of unrest in his country. Hello, everyone, and thanks for tuning in to World News. Our top story, Iran's Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi has announced a prisoner swap deal with the U.S. In a tweet, Araghchi said that 10 prisoners on all sides may be released on Sunday if the U.S. and the U.K. fulfill their share of obligations under the deal. He stressed the exchange will take place on humanitarian grounds and that Washington and London need to stop linking the swap with nuclear talks. Araghchi said that Vienna talks on reviving the 2015 nuclear agreement will resume after the administration of President-elect Ebrahim Raisi takes charge. 3 years after Washington's unilateral withdrawal, Iran and the remaining signatories to the nuclear deal began talks in April to revive the accord. British Health Secretary Sajid Javid says that he has tested positive for COVID-19 as the country faces a fresh surge in infections.
Hi everyone, I just wanted to update you all that I've tested positive for COVID. I was feeling a bit groggy last night, so I took a lateral flow test this morning and it's come out positive. So I'm now self-isolating at home with my family until I get the results of a PCR test. I'm grateful that I've had
two jabs of the vaccine. In the video posted on Twitter, the 51-year-old said that he's fully vaccinated and his symptoms are very mild. Javid has been health secretary for only 3 weeks. He was named to the post after Matt Hancock resigned for breaching social distancing guidelines. Javid has supported Prime Minister Boris Johnson's plan to lift all lockdown restrictions in England this coming Monday. Scientists have warned that the move is a threat to the world and provides fertile ground for the emergence of vaccine-resistant variants. On Saturday, Britain recorded 41 deaths and nearly 55,000 new infections, and it's the highest daily caseload since mid-January. Two-thirds of adults in the UK have been fully vaccinated. Thousands of people have taken to the streets of the French capital to protest the government's new COVID restrictions and vaccine mandates. Protesters voiced anger at the new rules that President Emmanuel Macron has announced. Measures include mandatory vaccination for healthcare workers. Unvaccinated people will also be required negative test results to enter public places. Demonstrations were held in a number of other French cities as well, including Nantes and Montpellier. Critics complain measures trample on freedoms and discriminate against people who choose not to get vaccinated. Thousands of French citizens also marched on Wednesday to denounce the plan, which will take effect in August. Russia reports over 25,000 new coronavirus infections, taking the overall caseload to nearly 6 million. Authorities also say nearly 800 people died from the disease in the past day. That pushes the overall COVID-related death toll to nearly 148,000. The country reported nearly 800 deaths on Friday alone, highest in a single day since the pandemic broke out in Russia. The country has been in the grips of a surge in cases, with authorities blaming the Delta variant and people's reluctance to get vaccinated. Capital Moscow and the second largest city of St. Petersburg remain the epicenters of the recent outbreak. Russia is the worst hit country in Europe by the pandemic in terms of both infections and fatalities. Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel says that the U.S. blockade on the Caribbean island, saying that Washington is seeking to destroy the unity of the Cuban people.
We have come together to once again denounce the U.S. blockade, aggression, and terror. We could not put off this rally. The enemy has once again given everything to destroy the sacred unity and peace of citizens.
Diaz-Canel called on the U.S. to lift its blockade of the country. The Cuban president made the remarks during a rally alongside his predecessor, Raul Castro, before thousands of supporters in Havana. He also denounced the social media's dissemination of false images of the recent protests as encouraging outrage and destruction of property. Speech came 6 days after anti-government demonstrations or the worst economic crisis in Cuba. One person died and over 100 others were arrested throughout the protests. Havana has blamed economic woes mainly on the U.S. sanctions and the coronavirus pandemic. Massive wildfires continue to rage and drought hit western U.S. and Canada amid record temperatures. Over 2,100 firefighters have been deployed to battle a vast bootleg fire raging in southern Oregon. Some of them were forced to retreat as dry, unstable, and windy conditions were fueling the fire. Bootleg fire is by far the biggest active blaze in America and covers an area larger than New York City. It's just 7% contained. Conflagration has forced 2,000 people to evacuate and is threatening 5,000 buildings. Fires have also scorched large swaths of land in Canada. 100 firefighters from Mexico have gone there to contain them. The discovery of several mass graves containing remains of children who attended Catholic residential schools in Canada has renewed the debate on the historic mistreatment of the indigenous people in the country. Researchers say the graves found so far are only the tip of the iceberg.
The discovery of an unmarked graveyard at a former residential school run by the Catholic Church in the Canadian province of British Columbia in May, which contained at least 215 human remains, mostly young children, prompted an outpouring of grief and anger and a wider investigation into similar boarding schools that were opened from the late 19th century to the mid-1990s. The probes have so far found some 1,100 bodies at the sites of former residential schools in the provinces of British Columbia and Saskatchewan. A Canadian researcher whose works contributed to the uncovering of the first mass grave has said the discoveries so far have barely scratched the surface. The residential school system in Canada was established in 1883 under the country's first Prime Minister, Sir John A. Macdonald. The aim was to assimilate Indigenous peoples in Canada and destroy their languages and culture. By the 1920s, attending residential schools had been made mandatory for children aged between 7 and 15.
But these have been going on for years. The residential school survivors just basically were ignored. Now today, it seems a shock to some people, but it shouldn't be a shock because this was known that it was the policy in Canada. It was also the policy in the United States. They just pulled these kids out of their homes, and they wanted to indoctrinate them. And that's exactly what they tried to do.
Some 150,000 children were separated from their parents, often under threats of persecution.
So far, 1,323 bodies have been discovered at various sites across Canada. For over a century, Canada's residential school system separated First Nations children from their families and exposed them to all sorts of abuse. Mistreatment of the children, some say as young as 3 years old, is well within living memory. How can the Canadian government redress the grievances of the First Nations population?
The first mass grave in British Columbia was found after Indigenous elders recollected the memories of young children digging holes in the ground. The survivors have told harrowing stories of how the mistreatment and abuse the children were subjected to at the former residential schools led some to attempt suicide or try to escape.
Many of our children who ran away during the winter and froze to death on their way home. And the quiet, the black robes start lying about the children. Oh, yeah, they're doing fine here. In the meantime, they were missing, and no one had searched for them.
A former student of the Cooper Island Industrial School has described the place as Canada's Alcatraz. In a 2015 report, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada called the practices employed in the former schools, quote, cultural genocide.
We're trying to say, people trying to say now, cultural genocide, as if it doesn't fit in the description of the word genocide. As defined by the United Nations. I mean, it's very clear that that's what they did.
These are the hard truths that are part of Canada's history. These are the hard truths we must confront as a society.
The Canadian government has vowed to fulfill the Indigenous people's demands to fund investigations into the graves around the country. But it's come under criticism for failing to do so earlier, as the discoveries made so far have been funded by the Indigenous groups themselves. The First Nations leaders say over 6,000 children died at the schools from causes like disease, accident, and suicide, but there's no clear picture of how many children lost their lives throughout the years. That means there will be more headlines about mass graves discoveries around Canada in the months to come.
European High Court of Justice has ruled in favor of European businesses who want to sack employees for wearing religious clothing in front of customers. Although the court did not say the ban was meant to be implemented fairly and neutrally, many predict it will unfairly be used to target Muslim women, many of whom wear the hijab or the niqab. Robert Carter reports.
Shock has rippled through the Muslim community after the European Union's highest court ruled that businesses can sack Muslim women for wearing the hijab if they work face-to-face with customers or if the wearing of the religious clothing causes workspace conflicts. The ruling was in response to a case brought by two German Muslim female workers who were asked by their employers not to wear Islamic headscarves while at work.
The decision has been met by claims that it will further fuel Islamophobia at this crucial time when countries in Europe such as France and Austria are already eliminating freedoms for Muslims, supposedly to combat extremism.
In Britain, several religious MPs, including Muslims and a Sikh, chastised the court, labelling the ruling as Islamophobic and deeply flawed. In addition, I spoke with a London-based female Muslim media personality about her fears for the future of Muslims in Europe.
To me, I feel oppressed, to be honest, by this decision. And I feel that I am now limited in my identity and my freedom of rights, freedom of belief, all the values that are actually supposedly meant to be Western, modern. Yes, part of it is a symbol of my faith, but it's so much more if you were to really understand what the hijab actually means or any sort of religious symbol. It is not just coming from one aspect. I think it's really unfair. And it's, again, it is targeting a particular group, especially the Muslim women, because we are the ones that are known to be wearing the headscarf known as the hijab.
Many activists warned that following the niqab ban, European powers would target the hijab next. They were right. But if the battle to protect the hijab is lost, what comes next? Robert Carter, London.
The repercussions of the Saudi-led war on Yemen are getting worse by the year. Thousands of the disabled in the war-torn country are deprived, that is, of their basic rights, such as access to medical care amid the apathy of international bodies. Our correspondent in Sana'a has her details.
Since the beginning of the Saudi-led war on Yemen, thousands of civilians have lost their limbs, eyes, or got mentally disabled due to the lethal bombardment on civilian facilities. According to the Amnesty International, 4 million people with disabilities in Yemen face multiple challenges, and the number is growing up each year as the war continues.
We feel like there is deliberate negligence by the international organizations towards us, as they have not provided anything so far.
This comes as the number of disabled exceeds 4 million, according to the UN organizations. We call on the international organizations to come and see our sufferings. Most of us don't even have a wheelchair.
Yemen's Disabled Care Fund says it provides healthcare services for more than 200,000 disabled, including 50,000 children who are getting educational services as well. However, the fund is suffering from a shortage of money amid the continued absence of related international organizations.
The Disabled Care Fund suffers from many difficulties, including lack of resources. Meanwhile, there is a significant increase in the number of the disabled each year. Sometimes we cannot provide wheelchairs and medicines for some of the disabled. Unfortunately, the international organizations turned a blind eye to this humanitarian catastrophe. We call on all the related international bodies to fulfill their duty towards the disabled Yemenis and provide aid to this vulnerable group.
In late 2015, the Saudi-led coalition has bombed the Anour Center for Care and Rehabilitation of the Blind in Sana'a, inflicting heavy damages on it. Since the beginning of the Saudi war on Yemen in March 2015, the relentless bombardments of the kingdom have killed tens of thousands of civilians, including women and the children. Besides losing parts of their bodies, millions of people with disabilities are among those most oppressed groups amid what the United Nations has called the world's worst humanitarian crisis. They say the Saudi war and the blockade have turned their lives into a real tragedy. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
In the limelight.
One way of thinking about the US military's Niger operations is to see them as labs for warfare, testing new forms of observability and lethality guided by the US state's algorithmic gaze, the components of which are built from the kinds of metals and minerals that are extracted from Niger's mines. Dear listeners, This was part of an article written by Scott Temke, author. This article is published under the heading, West Africa, its latest testing ground for U.S. military artificial intelligence. Stay tuned for more. One striking feature of U.S. military involvement in West Africa is the absence of an observable strategic vision for a desired end state. Nominally, U.S. presence in the region's multi-layered conflicts revolves around building security cooperation with state partners to improve counterterrorism capabilities, ostensibly providing protection to communities that states cannot. Concurrently, the U.S. military is typically the prime diplomatic entity for high-level bilateral engagements. The result is that the U.S. military is propping up the public authority of weak states, albeit in an ad hoc fashion that lurches from crisis to crisis. Regardless of the reasons for U.S. presence, there is hardly any deep public support for these operations. About 60% of U.S. citizens do not view these kinds of conflicts as a security threat, and more than 90% oppose U.S. invasions, even if weapons of mass destruction were in use. For the first time in recent memory, U.S. international relations scholar John Mearsheimer and Stephen Vogt write, large numbers of Americans are openly questioning their country's grand strategy. Even within the Department of Defense, these doubts continue to periodically arise. As former Defense Secretary Mark Esper testified in February 2020 to the House Armed Services Committee, conventional forces in Niger, Chad, and Mali need to go back to home so they can prepare for great power competition. Due to war fatigue, the U.S. has resorted to externalizing the strategic and operational burden of war to human and technological surrogates, creating what some scholars call a form of surrogate warfare. One example of externalizing the burden of the war to the machine is a tool created by Defense Innovation Unit and deployed at the Al Udeid Air Base in Qatar in 2017. Throughout its deployments, this tool monitored and rapidly combined social media feeds in Syria before relaying that information to pilots and ground troops, who then used it to identify, track, and strike targets in that area of operations. General Joseph Votel, then commander of U.S. Central Command, boasted of the model's success and indicated that it would be replicated in future operations. In its preparation for great power competition, the U.S. military is modernizing its joint airborne intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, that is ISR, capabilities by exploring the uses of artificial intelligence and machine learning techniques for target identification. The final goal is to connect ISR sensors across all warfighting domains, including space, air, land, sea, and cyber, directly with commanders and weapon systems, sharing data at an accelerated speed. In Niger, this project has materialized as the deployment of the new Block 5 variant of MQ-9 Reaper, a drone first used in Syria in 2017. The Block's fifth major upgrades include the ability to integrate and combine multiple data feeds, as well as to process this data more quickly. Since 2018, the U.S. has similarly armed their drones in Niger. In this fashion, West Africa joins Syria as a place that has become a testbed for this new wave of ISR technologies. The ISR modernization program follows prior U.S. military investment in the region with projects like the Trans-Saharan Counterterrorism Partnership, a military aid package of $353 million. These military initiatives contribute to the African continent's status as a long-standing field site for experimentation that traverses the colonial and post-colonial eras. More recently, since the publication of the Burke Report, Africa has been a proving ground for the neoliberal thought that permeates development economics, advocating for structural adjustment policies while most foreign direct investment is concentrated in resource extraction economies. This thinking tended to stop well short of acknowledging the enduring damage done by colonialism on the continent. Niger's colonial experience was particularly vicious, with French military violence used to pacify the territory. This trend continued in the lead-up to Niger's 1960 independence. As French military forces suppressed opposition so the French state could consolidate control over uranium deposits discovered between 1957 and 1967 and other minerals useful for high technology industries. Today, uranium from French mines accounts for about 70% of Niger's exports, but tax exemptions mean that little of that value flows to state or its citizens. It is against this background that Niger provides a good case study of intersection between the rural poor's land struggles and U.S. military presence. Most Nigerians are subsistence farmers whose land tenure rights are insecure. The country is susceptible to frequent drought and severe food shortages, conditions which have been exacerbated by climate change. As of 2004, 9% of Nigerians, about 870,000 people, were enslaved or lived as bonded laborers. One way of thinking about the U.S. military's Niger operations is to see them as labs for warfare, testing new forms of observability and lethality guided by U.S. state algorithmic gaze, the components of which are built from the kinds of metals and minerals that are extracted from Niger's mines. Arguably, because of a strategic non-oversight, West Africa is conducive for testing these weapon systems and assessing how they form a kind of predatory formation that spans from the borders to the hinterlands of the world.
IRIB English Radio presents
Viewpoints,
the presence of different scholars.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm your humble host, Muzaffar Haidar. Here in the studio today, we have with us Sayyid Mathi and Sheikh Ali. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
It's great to have you here. We've been discussing about the Iranian election system, and we've been talking about how the Western propaganda is often attacking Iran. Lots and lots of interesting points that Sheikh Ali and Sayyid Mathi brought up last time about the personality of Sayyid Raisi. I'd like to actually evolve this discussion a bit more now, taking it to Sayyid Mehdi, inshallah. This idea of Iran having an election process, right, and then the Western powers attacking it. We mentioned how the Western media is attacking and how they've got a history of doing this. Why do they do it again?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It's interesting, in one of the previous programs we talked about some of the reasons on why this Western propaganda or the mass media of the West in general has attacked these democratic elections in the Islamic Republic of Iran. One of the things that comes to mind is the fact that the neoliberal or liberal democratic systems of the world, the Western world, they do not want this Islamic Republic system to spread beyond the borders of the Islamic Republic of Iran. So this Islamic Republic system, which again is based upon Islam, based upon the Quran, it's based upon the traditions of the Holy Prophet, this system of the Islamic Republic, again, which was put forth by Imam Khomeini, I'm giving due credit to everywhere where it should be given, and then this Islamic Republic, which has been sustained and continued and strengthened by Imam Khamenei, this system is something which is a very serious threat to this global hegemony of the Western world and of imperialist colonialist powers. And so this, in my mind, is one of the reasons why... One of the reasons why they are really doing as much as they can to make the system and the elections and the whole thing seem like a sham.
You know, I just wanted to point out that it's not just the West. Back then, it was the communist power in the East as well. Now, the Soviet Union has fallen, and the big bad guy in today's world is the Western power, right? Is the great Satan America and its cohorts.
If I can add right there to this thought and build on top of it. See, we back in the day, we had this liberal democracy as a model of governance. Then the Russia, USSR, you know, the Soviet, they had the communism as the working model, right? Communist government, communism has its own ideology. These were the only two blocks or only two options for the countries of the world to choose from.
Yes, and right? Every other country was basically just choosing, should I side with them, should I side with them? Should I go into their pocket or their pocket?
Right, so there were these two camps, and you can either join them or you can just take parts of their system and implement in your country and run your country. This was the option, the two only two options. What the Islamic Republic and the Islamic Revolution and the concept and the belief of Wilayatul Faqih did, at least for the Muslim nations, is to present a third option. Okay, this is huge. When you're looking at the world at a macro level, this is huge. You're providing a political system, a method of governing your country and deciding your own fate. This option did not exist before. And why I said at least Muslim countries, because I personally believe, and I have logical reasoning for that, why this system is also applicable and viable and feasible for non-Muslim countries. And I know right off the bat people are not going to agree with me, but this is something that I can discuss. I'm ready to prove in my own way.
I would love to discuss that. Because
this is the only divine solution in the time of the occultation of Imam. Again, I don't want to go on a tangent, right? When the Imam comes, we're going to have Imam Mahdi, Hajjalallahu ta'ala Faraja Sharif. He's going to be ruling the world. That one world, inshallah, one government, right? In his occultation, I still think that the divine principles of Islam can benefit all the nations out there, not just the Muslim nations.
That again, is an absolutely beautiful thought that you said. And it is a bit of a tangent, but Sayyid Mehdi, I think you'd agree that it's a beautiful tangent.
Yeah, of course, right? So when we talk about Islam in itself as a, you know, as an existence or as a being, so Islam, all of the tenets and the basic principles and the concepts and the ideas and the philosophy, the ethics, the morality, the laws, all of these things that are within Islam are
social
universal.
Social justice system.
The social justice, right? And really, if you were to implement this thing, Islam on a global level, you will find that it promotes truth and justice and equality and And that's something that is universal. I just wanted to add something that was really interesting about this political theory, this third political theory that was brought forth by Imam Khomeini in an era where you had two global superpowers, the communists and the capitalists, against each other. It seems like history tends to repeat itself. Now, how true that is, I don't know. It's something that can be researched. But the thing that came immediately to my mind, with all due respect to each on its own, was during the time of the Holy Prophet when Islam came forth. You had two global superpowers at that time as well, right? You had the Romans on one side, and you had the Persians on the other side. And either the world had sided with the Persians, or the world had sided with the Romans. There was no third.
Yeah, or had been dominated by
or had been dominated by either one of these two. And then you had this Islam come forth in the middle. And again, Islam wasn't just limited to that area. It was a global phenomenon. So I thought that was an interesting thing to add to this.
Point. And just to add to that as well, it's interesting how once Islam rose, the Eastern Bloc, in other words, the Persian Empire, kind of fizzled away in history. It's the Romans that actually remained for the longest time. The same thing has happened after the Islamic Revolution, where the Eastern Bloc, represented by the Soviet Union, kind of disappeared. It actually collapsed. And now we're dealing with the same old thing, the Western power. Yeah, coming back to this idea of Imam Khomeini, Islam, in fact, having presented an alternate to the entire world for a feasible socio-political system that can have an effect, you know, it can be put into effect, in fact, across the world. And as you mentioned, even in non-Muslim countries, what stands out really profoundly is the fact that they attacked the concept of Sharia from the onset. You know, I don't know how much it was in the US, but in the UK, we had this whole thing about, you know, Sharia laws coming to the UK. And, you know, they created a whole hoo-ha and the propaganda was massive. And people were trying to explain that, hold on, Sharia isn't as bad as you think it is. But people are terrified of it. They're actually terrified of Sharia. But that's actually what, at least a part of what we're talking about being implemented.
I want to, because this is interesting, and then I'll pass it over to Sheikh Ali. So I've been following this kind of idea of what you just talked about at least since September 11th, 2001. Okay? So we are right now, 2021. I've been following this concept since 2001, so over 20 years at least.
You don't look that old.
No, thank you. Yeah, I'm actually close to 50 years old, but... what's interesting here is that in the last 20 years, not only have they attacked the Sharia, right, this divine legislation of God, okay, you will find that there are a lot of Islamic so-called symbols or things that are connected with Islam which have been attacked in the last 20 years, right? So whether it's an individual who wears a turban, whether it's an individual who wears a black turban, whether it's a person who wears religious clothes, whether it's a person as simple as somebody who has a beard. Now, these things that I'm listing are things that have been demonized and have been showed in a negative context in the Western global media empire for the last two decades, over 20 years. A person having a beard, a person wearing a turban, a woman wearing a hijab, a woman wearing a burqa. Hold on. And then there's terms like Islam, Islamic State, Mujahideen, Taliban. Look, Mujahideen is somebody who fights and strives on the path of God. This is a Mujahideen. They took it to these crazy Taliban fight. Taliban is from Talabe. Talabe is a student. You know, in our context, an Islamic seminary student. Right?
Absolutely.
They took this terminology, Islamic State and the Levant, right? So for example, you have an Islamic Republic, they took Islamic State and they turned it around. The Caliph, right? Abu Bakr Baghdadi, he was known as the Caliph of the Islamic State. They have taken so many terminologies of Islam and demonized it in order to scare. And why? If you look at 2001, Islam was at that point the fastest growing religion in the world, including the Western world. And that is
absolutely
these attacks started. Go ahead.
No, I just wanted to make an additional observation because you mentioned the black turban. But did you notice that Takfiri Wahhabis, generally speaking, it is not a recognized symbol of Takfiri Wahhabism to actually wear a turban. However, they had a white turban on Osama bin Laden and a black one on Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi.
Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, if you look at Boko Haram, that guy, Abu Bakr Shekau, who I think he committed suicide because another Daesh group was going to take over, he used to wear a black turban. It's really weird. I mean,
it has been an orchestrated attack, like just visually, to bring the attention to Iran. Yeah.
Again, it's the phobia, right? The point is that these are the fear mongering techniques, right? Because what happens with general masses is they get scared, right? And when anything we are scared of, we're going to avoid it.
Yeah.
Right. So if you get scared of, let's say, an Islamic government, quote unquote, right? You are not going to put together an Islamic government, build an infrastructure for it, implement the rules of Islam, and no, because you're scared, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is basically what they tried to do with all of these things, and now they're trying to do it with Iran. Iran being a nuclear state, building these, building bombs, you know, that's all they show, right? Why do they show this? So they freak people out. They scare people off. And when people get scared and nations get scared and countries get scared, they are repellent to that idea. In this case, the Islamic Republic of Iran. They're not going to engage in business transactions. You know, they're not going to engage in trade.
Let alone consider adopting that political system.
Exactly, right? So this is the tactic that they're using, which our people need to, inshallah, understand and realize.
I mean, to just to continue your train of thought, this inculcating and injecting fear into the masses, it is a very easy way for governments and powers to control their people, right? If you consistently have your population under fear, right, fear causes certain amounts of stress. Imam Khamenei says that people who are cowards, meaning they have fear, they don't have the right to talk about rationality. Meaning what? It means that that fear creates an irrationality, an instability in people. And then what happens is you manipulate the vote. You manipulate the vote to an extent where you can manipulate the people due to fear to vote for somebody, you know, as racist as Donald Trump, for example. It is fear, either fear from this side, fear from that side, fear from Muslims, fear from black people, fear from Hispanics, fear from immigrants, fear from the Antifa. And so this is interesting. Islam is the exact opposite. It promotes courage and bravery, and it does. In just one tradition from the Holy Prophet, he says that even if you look at another Muslim in a manner which scares them, this is considered a sin.
Subhanallah, subhanallah.
Let alone Daesh and these crazy guys.
That's all we have time for, unfortunately. A fascinating discussion, inshallah, which we will be continuing, inshallah, next time. From myself and from our honorable guests, we bid you assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you so much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Viewpoints. You can log on to our website at parstoday.com, and you can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Until next time, goodbye. A symphony of nature. Oh, it's taking my breath away. I'm so blessed out here today. Yeah, Allah.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight. It is hard to avoid the conclusion that the Joe Biden administration's fiscal irresponsibility arises from a cynical political calculation. It evidently proposes to employ the federal budget as a slush fund to distribute benefits to various political constituencies, gambling that the avalanche of new debt will not cause a financial crisis before the 2022 congressional elections. We now present you an article written by David P. Goldman, president of Macro Strategy LLC and senior writer at Law and Liberty. The piece is titled U.S. Fiscal Profligacy and the Impending Crisis. The article has been published by the Asia Times Daily. Massive demand-side stimulus combined with the constraints on the supply side in the form of higher taxes is a sure recipe for inflation and eventual recession. According to the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, the fiscal year 2021 U.S. budget deficit will amount to 15% of America's GDP, or gross domestic product, after the passage of an additional $1.9 trillion in demand stimulus, a proportion that the United States has not seen since the Second World War. It is hard to avoid the conclusion that the Biden administration's fiscal irresponsibility arises from a cynical political calculation. It evidently proposes to employ the federal budget as a slush fund to distribute benefits to various political constituencies, gambling that the avalanche of new debt will not cause a financial crisis before the 2022 congressional elections. The additional $2.3 trillion in so-called infrastructure spending that the Biden administration has proposed consists mainly of handouts to Democratic constituencies. During the 12 months ending in March, the deficit stood at 19% of gross domestic product, or GDP. Even worse, the Federal Reserve absorbed virtually all the increase in outstanding debt on its balance sheet. In the aftermath of the 2009 recession, when the deficit briefly rose to 10% of the gross domestic product GDP, foreigners bought about half of the total new issuance of Treasury debt. During the past 12 months, foreigners have been net sellers of U.S. government debt. The U.S. dollar's role as the world's principal reserve currency is eroding fast, and fiscal irresponsibility of this order threatens to accelerate the dollar's decline. The U.S. Federal Reserve has kept short-term interest rates low by monetizing debt, but long-term Treasury yields have risen by more than a percentage point since last July. Markets know that what can't go on forever won't. At some point, private holders of U.S. Treasury debt will liquidate their holdings, as foreigners have begun to do, and rates will rise sharply. For every percentage point increase in the cost of financing federal debt, the U.S. Treasury will have to pay an additional $250 billion in interest. The United States well may find itself in the position of Italy in 2018, but without the rich members of the European Union to bail it out. The flood of federal spending has had a number of dangerous effects already. The U.S. trade deficit in goods as of February 2021 reached an annualized rate of more than $1 trillion a year, an all-time record. China's exports to the United States over the past 12 months, ending in February, also reached an all-time record. Federal stimulus created demand that the U.S. productive facilities could not meet and produced a massive import boom. According to Philadelphia Federal Reserve survey, input prices to U.S. manufacturers in February rose at the fastest rate since 1973. And the gap between input prices and finished goods prices rose at the fastest rate since 2009. The Producer Price Index, PPI, for final demand rose at an annualized 11% rate during the first quarter of this year. The Consumer Price Index, CPI, shows year-on-year growth of only 1.7%, but that reflects dodgy measurements. For example, the price shelter, which comprises a third of the index, supposedly rose just 1.5% over the year, although home prices rose by as much as 10%. If foreigners are net sellers of U.S. Treasury securities, how is the United States financing an external deficit in the range of $1 trillion a year? The United States has two deficits to finance, the internal budget deficit and the balance of payment deficit, and here we refer to this second deficit. The answer is, according to the Treasury data, by selling stocks to foreigners. According to the Treasury International Capital, or TIC system, foreign investors have been dumping low-yielding U.S. Treasuries and corporate bonds during the past year. Foreign investors bought $400 billion of U.S. equities and nearly $500 billion of U.S. agency securities backed by home mortgages during the 12 months through to January, but sold $600 billion of treasuries and $100 billion of corporate bonds. This is a bubble on top of a bubble. The U.S. Federal Reserve buys $4 trillion of treasury securities and pushes the after-inflation yield below zero. That pushes investors into stocks. Foreigners don't want U.S. treasuries at negative real yields, but they buy into the stock market, which keeps rising, because the U.S. Federal Reserve is pushing down bond yields and so forth. Today, however, the U.S. Treasury market is the weak link in the financial system, supported only by the central bank's monetization of debt. If the extreme fiscal profligacy of the Biden administration prompts private investors to exit the Treasury market, there will be no safe assets left in dollar financial markets. The knock-on effects would be extremely hard to control. The overwhelming majority of the over-the-counter privately traded derivatives contracts serve as interest rate hedges. Market participants typically pledge Treasury securities as collateral for those contracts. According to the Bank for International Settlements, the notional value of such contracts now exceeds $600 trillion. Derivative contracts entail a certain amount of market risk, and banks will enter into them with customers who want to hedge interest rate positions only if the customers put up collateral, like the cash margin on a stock bought on credit. The market value, after netting for matching contracts that cancel each other out, is about $15 trillion. If the prices of Treasury securities fall sharply, the result will be a global margin call in the derivatives market, forcing the liquidation of vast amounts of positions. Something like this occurred between 6th of March and 18th of March 2020, when the yield on inflation-protected U.S. Treasury securities, or TIPS, jumped from about negative 0.6% to positive 0.6% in just 2 weeks. The COVID-19 crash prompted a run on cash at American banks, as U.S. corporate borrowers drew down their credit lines. U.S. banks, in turn, cut credit lines to European and Japanese banks, who were forced to withdraw funding to their customers for currency hedges on holdings of U.S. Treasury securities. The customers, in turn, liquidated U.S. Treasury securities, and the Treasury market crashed. That was the first time that a Treasury market crash coincided with a stock market crash. Instead of acting as a crisis refuge, the U.S. Treasury market became the epicenter of the crisis itself. The U.S. Federal Reserve quickly stabilized the market through massive purchases of Treasury securities and through the extension of dollar swap lines to European central banks, which in turn restored dollar liquidity to their customers. The emergency actions were justified by the extraordinary circumstances of March of 2020. An external shock, namely the COVID-19 pandemic, upended financial markets, and the central bank acted responsibly in extending liquidity to the market. But the U.S. Federal Reserve and the Biden administration now propose to extend these emergency measures into a continuing flood of demand. The consequences will be dire. The present situation is unprecedented in another way as well. Not in the past century has the United States faced a competitor with an economy as big as ours, growing much faster than ours, in fact, with ambitions to displace us as the world's leading economic power. China believes that America's fiscal irresponsibility will undermine the dollar status as the world's reserve currency.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.